Our show's name pays tribute to the Voortrekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Voortrekker died and only three were wounded. Now, your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Dear precious Blood River Radio family, thank you so much for holding on. And like I say, thank you for listening to this hack. Hopefully within about 6 weeks, we'll get through all this surgery crap. I'll get rid of all this. But anyway, just to go back to clarify, we had a little technical mishap the first part of the show. I'm not going to say exactly when, but the first hour and a half, maybe something like that, went out as a recorded show, one of our older shows by mistake. See, I skipped 1 week because of illness. And TPC, they're playing a recorded show today. So, I mean, this gets what Lizzie does, what Jay do. I tell you what, it's a balancing act. And like my precious webmaster, he's a wizard. He said that no matter what you do, the things are so technical nowadays, you'll have little gremlins in there, and you won't know. Even Jay won't know what happens sometimes. But anyway, just to make it clear, do not worry about missing any part of the program today, because everything, as always, I knew, I never had a doubt in my mind, the entire program was going to be recorded. It always is, and it will be on the archives whenever. Now, that will be whenever whenever our webmaster gets it up. And it may be tomorrow after. It's usually here later. He's so busy. It might be Monday morning. But this entire program for today, for March 22nd, will be on the archives tomorrow. So anything you missed, don't worry. Most of our listeners listen to the archives anyway. So right now we have Sergeant Carter on and Private Gomer Powell. They're having they're catching hell, Bucko. The general himself, the sword destroying General Bitter Ender, is in here. He's kicking ass on everybody. So anyway, go ahead, General Bitter Ender, take it over, brother.
All right, Eddie, thank you very much for that classic introduction. Right. I've never been introduced like that, but that there's always a first for everything. No, with your permission, what I thought we'd do today, the first segment, maybe the first two segments, when we were talking about our Confederate history and the battles and things that went on during our war for Southern independence, a lot of times we use terms that some of our listeners may not be familiar with. So I thought for the first part of the show today, we'd just go through and explain what a company is, a regiment, a brigade, about how many people are in there, the officers that command them, and the names of the armies that they had back then, and kind of get our listeners caught up to speed on what some of the military terms that were used in the 1800s. So we'll start off with the armies. Today we have numerical designations for armies, like Patton's Third Army in Europe during World War II. But back in the 1860s, the Confederate armies were named for states. For instance, the Army of Northern Virginia is probably the most famous Confederate army because its commander stayed with it throughout the entire war. Robert E. Lee took over right after the battle at Gaines Mill when Joseph E. Johnston was wounded, and Lee took over the Army of Northern Virginia and stayed with it through the rest of the war all the way to the surrender at Appomattox. Out here in the Western theater of the war, it was the Army of Tennessee, and that was the one that was commanded at times by Albert Sidney Johnston and Braxton Bragg and John Bell Hood through the war. There was also an Army of Mississippi that defended Vicksburg. Now, on the U.S. side, they named their armies after rivers. And the army in Washington that fought against Lee's army and the Confederates throughout most of the war in the East was the Army of the Potomac. In the Western theater of the war, there were several of them that were named for rivers in this part of the country. So the Army of the Cumberland was a federal army. The Army of the Tennessee, as in the Tennessee River, was a federal army. And the Army of the Mississippi was a federal army. So the federal armies were named after rivers. The Confederate armies were named after states. The 1860s organization of both the Confederate and the U.S. Military was pretty much the same all over the world, just like the British, the French, and the Prussians did too. The smallest unit that was used then as a military unit was the company. It was a local unit, It had a TO strength, and TO strength means table of organization. And that tells you in the military how many people are supposed to be in this unit, enlisted and officers, and what rank officers this unit rates. So the TO strength of a company was around 100 men if it were full strength, and it would be commanded by a captain. Now, they would have lieutenants also in the company and not as platoon commanders like we have in the modern Army today. A company was seldom at full strength. It was raised locally. All 100 came from the same county or the same town. And they would take the name of the area where that company was raised. For instance, the Murray County Grays, Murray County in Tennessee, Columbia. Or that was Sam Watkins' unit in Company H of the Murray County Grays. The Rock City Guards in Nashville. And a lot of people didn't know this, but Nashville was known as Rock City before they built Rock City down in Chattanooga. And if you've ever tried to dig a water line or plant a tree in Nashville, you know why it was called Rock City. And then they had like the New York Invincibles, and the companies in the next big unit, which is a regiment, companies were lettered A through I. Now, the next unit was a regiment, and that was the main unit of the 1800s, and it was also raised locally. And the reason they got away from that, now you have soldiers in the Army in a unit, they're from Tennessee, Washington State, New York, Texas, Florida. They mix them all together, because if a regiment or a company went into a battle and they took extremely high casualties and that unit was wiped out, there went every young man in that town or that county. So now the idea is to mix them up, so if they do take a lot of losses, it doesn't devastate the young male population in that particular town or county. So Gene, the regiment was made up of 10 companies. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. What did you say?
I was going to say, you remind me of something. Do you remember the Fighting Sullivans?
Yeah.
They all brothers all went down in one ship. That's what made me think about that. They don't allow. Well, I'll let you go ahead. You might want to talk about that.
No, but that's why they don't allow that. You know, if that ship sank and you had a bunch of brothers on there, all of them were gone, wiped out that entire family. Yeah.
Yep. That's what happened. Let me give an example of
what happened. The University Grays were raised in Oxford, Mississippi, and in 1861, the University of Mississippi was closed, because all the faculty and all the student body joined the Confederate Army. And they were the University Grays. They later became Company B of the 11th Mississippi Infantry Regiment. And they took losses through the war, but by the third day at the Battle of Gettysburg, that unit was wiped out. They were either killed or so severely wounded that they were sent home or sent back out of the Army. So the University Grays were wiped out, and that's why the University of Mississippi adopted the nickname Rebels, and their uniforms were red, white, blue, and gray, from the red, white, and blue of the Confederate flag and the gray from the uniforms. And you know, we can both remember times when the stadium in Oxford, Mississippi for a home game of Ole Miss was absolutely red with all the Confederate yes. flags that the students were waving and fans were waving. Of course, they've gotten away from that now. They banned the flag. I guess they've changed the nickname to politically correct suck-ups or whatever
yes.
the nickname is now. But that was why the University of Mississippi took the nickname Rebels. And that carried over a lot of schools. The LSU Tigers, there was a unit from Louisiana that served under Stonewall Jackson in the Army of Northern Virginia, Robert Wheat's Louisiana Tigers. And they were one of the toughest units in the Army of Northern Virginia. So when they started looking for a nickname for LSU, Louisiana State University, they said, oh, yeah, Bob Wheat's Louisiana Tigers. So that's why we have the LSU Tigers. So anyway, that's where that came from. The regiment, like we said, was 10 companies, and it was divided into two battalions. There would be five regiments in one battalion, five regiments in the other battalion. And that made it a little bit easier to maneuver out on the battlefield or command. And a battalion was commanded by a lieutenant colonel. And then the regiment which had two battalions, would be commanded by a full colonel. One interesting point we'll make for our listeners, when you're looking at the combat effectiveness of these regiments that fought in the war, in the early part of the war, a Confederate regiment could always defeat a U.S. Army regiment. And not just because it was made up of Southerners, although that's a great idea. That's a good reason for it. But it was the difference of organization. In the Confederate Army, when new recruits came in, they would split them up and put them in these old regiments where people had died or had been sent home with wounds. And we'll go back and explain what happened to that after we come back from our break.
As usual, I didn't know that, and I would come back and hear about it too, Gene. Be right back, folks.
This is a battle between truth and deceit, a battle between forces that would enslave this country in darkness and between a media that wants to present you with the truth.
We are being censored. America's news outlets no longer provide the truth. 90% of news outlets in the United States are controlled by 6 corporations. The mission of the Epoch Times is to chase the truth, to ground all statements in fact.
TheEpochTimes.com.
During our war for Southern independence, the brilliant Confederate general Robert E. Lee foretold the decline of this country when he prophesied, if those people, referring to the dictatorial federal government, if those people win this war, the United States will become a bully abroad and a tyrant at home. As Lee predicted, it has come to pass. The principles laid out in our founding documents, our Declaration of Independence, and the individual rights protected in our Constitution have been vilified and discarded. But not everyone has surrendered. Blood River Radio brings you highly respected, intelligent guests not afraid to speak the truth when the truth in America today is censored and attacked. Your contributions keep us on the air in order to fight against the bullies abroad and the tyrants at home. Send your war contributions to Blood River Radio, P.O. Box 34636, Bartlett, Tennessee 38184. That address is on our website, www.bloodriverradio.com. Don't let the bullies and the tyrants win.
Looking for an IT partner that truly understands your needs? Managed IT Services is the answer. We meet with you regularly to discuss your goals and form a tailored technology plan. Our customers have called us a trusted advisor who delivers. When it comes to IT, we do it all. Firewalls, cloud storage, server migration, and more. Say goodbye to long-term contracts and hello to a team that earns your business month after month. Call 801-706-6980 now and let Managed IT Services transform your IT experience.
Dear Blood River Radio family, without further ado, we're going to go right back to the Peter Ender because I didn't know what he was telling me then. Of course, most of the stuff he does say, I don't know. But I'm really interested in this and curious. Go ahead, Peter Ender.
Okay, we were talking before the break why in the early part of the war, the average Confederate regiment, which is 10 companies, supposed to be about 1,000 men, usually it was less than that on both sides. And why the average Confederate regiment was better than the U.S. regiment. And it wasn't necessarily because it was all Southerners, although that's what we like to think, but it was because of organization. In the Confederate Army, when new recruits came in, they were divided up and put into these old regiments. And so now you had this green kid or raw recruit fighting between two veterans on either side of him. And they would turn to him and just tell him, Private Miller, get your head down. You're going to get it shot off, boy. or show you how to sleep out on the ground at night when it was snowing and sleeting and freezing rain and not die of hypothermia, although the cold had exposure back then. So you had veterans training these raw recruits that were coming into the Army, in the Confederate Army. In the Union Army, Abraham Lincoln got more political support and backing if he would hand out these commissions for a colonel to political allies or buddies to the Republican Party. And he just passed those things out like they were prizes out of a Cracker Jack box. And they would go out and raise a regiment, and sometimes it would only be 200 or 300 people, nowhere close to that 1,000. And when that regiment, as small as it was, took casualties, they wouldn't put new recruits into that regiment and build it back up to strength. Lincoln would hand out another commission for colonel to somebody else to go raise another regiment. So now the Union Army,
God,
most of the time, the total strength of the Union armies that fought against the Confederates was always superior to the numbers in the Confederate Army. Very few battles. I think Chickamauga was the only battle where the Confederate Army actually outnumbered the U.S. Army. So army to army, the Confederate Army was always outnumbered. But then the Confederates were fighting, say they had 25 regiments in their army. They would be fighting a Union army that would have 45 or 50 regiments. But if you pulled one of those regiments out of the Union army to fight a Confederate regiment one-on-one, the Confederates were going to win because they probably had 700 or 800, and the Union regiment had, you know, maybe 100 or 200 in it. But it was still commanded by a colonel that had gotten his commission from Lincoln as a political ploy. So the strength of the two armies were always favored the U.S. Army in total numbers. But regiment to regiment, the Confederate usually came out ahead early in the war. And then you got down to toward the end of the war, 63 and 64, the manpower of the South was just decimated. They couldn't replace their losses. And you would see a lot of consolidated regiments. It would have like the 9th, 41st, 50th, and 55th Tennessee Regiment as one regiment, but still probably only about 600 people, way smaller than what it had during the war. The next unit that came along was the brigade, and that was commanded by a brigadier general, and it would have from anywhere to 4 to 6 regiments. And oftentimes they were organized by states like Granbury's Texas Brigade or Claiborne's Arkansas Brigade or Frank Cheatham's Tennessee Brigade. And it also went up to Army of Northern Virginia, the Stonewall Brigade, that was organized and commanded first by Thomas Jackson. And of course, they got the nickname, he got the nickname Stonewall at the battle at First Manassas, where they said, there stands Jackson's men standing like a stonewall, rally behind the Virginians. And he got the nickname Stonewall Jackson. He was always embarrassed by that. He said, no, that belongs to the men. They're the ones that earned that nickname. So the Stonewall Brigade was part of the Army of Northern Virginia. The next major military organization in the Army was the division. And this was commanded by a major general. And it would have anywhere from two to four brigades, usually about three. And this was the confusing part in the Confederate Army. The Confederates used the names for brigades, divisions, and corps. They used the name of the original commander, like A.P. Hill's Corps, James Longstreet's Corps, Frank Cheatham's Corps. And if that commander were killed or promoted from brigade to division or up to corps commander, that unit still kept the name of the old commander, but now it was under new commander. In the U.S. Army, they used Arabic numbers for battalions, regiments, and brigades, and divisions. And in the Army Corps in the U.S. Army, they used the Roman numerals, like an I and two I's and IV and so forth, like that. And it didn't matter who the commander was. It was still the 1st Brigade, 2nd Division, 3rd Corps, Army of the Potomac, like that. So then the next unit in the Army, bigger unit, was the Corps, Army Corps. And that was commanded by a major general or a lieutenant general, and an Army Corps was usually made up from anywhere to 2-3 division. And once again, this used the Confederate Army used the names Leonidas Polk's Corps or Jackson's in the Army of Northern Virginia. It was James Longstreet's Corps or Jackson's 2nd Corps. And like I said earlier, the United States Army used the Roman numerals for that. So that would pretty much cover the same organization of units in infantry or cavalry in either Army, Confederate or U.S. Now, the cavalry was about the same organization, as we said, company, regiments, battalions, division. And usually those units were a little bit larger than the infantry because the cavalry had to have horse holders. And in the cavalry, every fourth man was designated as a horse holder. So when they went into battle and the cavalry was going to dismount and fight on foot, which is what Forrest's cavalry did all the time, he used the horses to make his men mounted infantry. and the horses were just used to get from point A to point B in a hurry, then dismount and fight on foot, which is much more effective than trying to ride and shoot and reload a pistol while you're bouncing along on a horse's back. It was much more accurate rifle fire and much easier to control if they were on foot. So every fourth man was designated as a horse holder. When the unit went into action, he'd take the reins of his horse and three other horses and get them out of the way. So the horses did get killed, take them down in a ravine or behind a hill or somewhere. Because in the Confederate Army, the Confederate cavalry soldier had to furnish his own horse. And if your horse went lame or got killed, tough, you were on foot till you could get another horse. So they had to take care of the horses. Yeah, there you go. And usually the horse holders were young boys, 15, 16 years old, or old men that couldn't do as much fighting up on the front line. And another, use of the cavalry, they were scouts, they were reconnaissance, or formed the rear guard of the army. Now, the other combat arm was artillery. And in artillery, two guns or field pieces would make up a section, and a lieutenant commanded a section. He was in charge of two guns. And then a battery would it be anywhere from four to six guns, and a battery commander would be a captain. And so you'd have anywhere from two to three sections in a battery, and that was commanded by a captain. And what they tried to do, both armies, would have all the artillery pieces or the guns in that battery fire the same type of ammunition. The most used artillery piece in the war, both sides, was the 12-pound brass Napoleon howitzer. It's a long name, but it was a 12-pound shot that was fired. The barrel was brass. It was designed by Emperor Napoleon III of France, and it was a howitzer which fired sort of an indirect shot. Now, they also had 6-pound howitzers, which had a shorter barrel, a lot of times used by cavalry or troops in the mountains. So the brass Napoleon had a range of about 800 yards. Now, these things are pretty accurate because they had an elevating screw at the rear of the barrel. You can raise the barrel up or down. And then they could measure the degrees of angle on the barrel and know exactly how far that round was going to go and how close it was going to come to a target at 200 yards, 300, 400, 500, 600 yards.
Quick question.
Like that. Yes, sir. Fire.
Oh, I hope it don't slow you down. Were there any artillery batteries that were famous for being dead eye dick, being really good, any more famous than others?
The Washington Artillery and the Army of Northern Virginia had quite a reputation, and they were raised in Louisiana and took the name Washington. And there were several other batteries that came out of Louisiana that were really good. Let me see. I'm trying to think of some others that were known for their accuracy and their John Pelham in Army of Northern Virginia with Jeb Stuart's cavalry, some of the artillery he commanded, light artillery with the cavalry, were really good. They would, at the Battle of Fredericksburg, he took his men out away from the Confederate line and harassed the Federal attempts to cross the Rappahannock River and get at the Confederates at Fredericksburg. And they were watching him, and I think it was Jackson that was telling Lee, or maybe it was Longstreet, they were commenting, said, it's amazing to see courage in somebody that young. And so, yeah there were some very famous artillery units.
I knew you would know.
Yeah, but they really were. They were sort of the backbone of the Army there. Another piece of artillery that they used was a 3-inch ordnance gun. So they would tell you by the weight of the shell that it fired or the dimension of the bore. And 3-inch ordnance gun. They had a longer range. Some of them were actually rifled, where they would cut a groove in the barrel, so when the round came out, it was spinning. So we will finish this up after the next segment and then go to our March history item.
I'm sure as anxious as I'm sure our listeners are. Hang on, folks. Be right back.
Exposing corruption, informing citizens, pursuing liberty. You're listening to Liberty News Radio.
News this hour from townhall.com. I'm Jason Walker. Another mass shooting, this time in the Southwest.
Police in Las Cruces, New Mexico say at least 3 people are dead and 14 others are injured in a mass shooting at a park. Police are asking for bystanders to share videos and other tips as they look for a suspect or suspects. The shooting happened Friday night in the city's Young Park, a place for music and recreation. The mayor pro tem of Las Cruces, Joanna Bencomo, issued a statement saying, "Honestly, nowadays, a tragedy like this feels like a nightmare just waiting to come true at any possible moment, yet also always praying and hoping it never will." I'm Donna Water.
Also at townhall.com, former Justice Department spokesman, attorney Mark Weaver, says there's a good reason the DOJ is proceeding with caution in bringing criminal charges against officials who may have committed crimes during the Biden administration.
Well, let's remember that the other branches or the other departments in government, the Interior Department, the Treasury Department, they can get a lot done without the other branches. But the Justice Department has to go to the judicial branch to get something done.
And he adds Attorney General Pam Bondi has been slow to bring charges against some who may have committed crimes under Biden because the DOJ works hand in hand with other branches of government.
So unlike the other departments within the Trump administration, the Justice Department has to get everything right because they're interacting with both of the other two branches.
British government ordering an investigation into the country's energy resilience after an electrical substation fire shut down Heathrow Airport for nearly 24 hours. The airport says it is now fully operational, although things are running a bit slow. More on these stories at townhall.com.
Heard me talk about Relief Factor and how so many people enjoy a better, more pain-free life because of it. If you're dealing with everyday pain, it makes sense you'd want to try it first. Well, Relief Factor makes that pretty pain-free, too, with their 3-week quick start kit for only $19.95. An easy, affordable way to see how it could literally change your life, like it has mine. Relief Factor is a daily supplement that fights pain naturally. Developed by doctors, Relief Factor doesn't just mask pain temporarily. It helps reduce or eliminate pain. In fact, the longer you take it, the more effective it is. Try and it couldn't be easier with their 3-week quick start for only $19.95, less than a dollar a day. And it just takes a phone call to 1-800-4-RELIEF. That's 1-800-4-RELIEF. 1-800-4-RELIEF. Wherever you're having pain, every day you feel better is a day you live better. Try Relief Factor's 3-week quick start. Visit ReliefFactor.com. That's ReliefFactor.com. Or call 1-800-4-RELIEF. 800-4-RELIEF for Relief Factor.
This is Michael Hill, Chief of the League of the South. I listen to Blood River Radio, and you should too. In fact, you should be telling your friends, your family, and your associates to listen to Eddie Miller and the good folks at Blood River Radio. They stand resolutely for the preservation of white civilization, what we once called Christendom, and they stand against the ongoing campaign of white genocide. In these trying and uncertain times, it's more important than ever to speak and act in defense of our God, our people, and our civilization. Blood River Radio speaks the truth and speaks it boldly. I've been on this show many times as a guest, and I'm very proud of my association with you. May our just cause prevail. Hail victory.
Have you ever had great honey? No, I mean really good, all-natural, raw honey. Well, now you can, thanks to localhoneyman.com. We can ship out our locally made honey all across the U.S. So don't worry, you won't miss out. Plus, Local Honeyman has so many different flavors, like Utah Wildflower, High Desert Delight, Happy Valley, and Blackberry, just to name a few. So purchase your delicious raw honey today at localhoneyman.com.
Do you treasure your liberty? Well, at LovingLiberty.net, we most certainly do. And we want to help protect your liberty, too. Become part of the family. Everyone knows that the core of any society is the family. Therefore, the government should foster and protect the integrity of its family, we the people. Won't you join us as a Loving Liberty sponsor to help us promote the principles in the 5,000-year leap? Let's restore the miracle that changed the world at LovingLiberty.net.
Being this is a 44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, punk?
Dear Blood River Radio family, got to make this quick announcement. Listen, this Confederate history, we're not trying, I want you to know, it really pisses me off when people say, why do you have that old Confederate history? Of course, quit trying to refight the Civil War. First of all, it wasn't a Civil War, but Gene's covered that 1,000 times. But here's why we do it. We do this, and I have to consider it our sacred duty on Blood River Radio. We're so thankful to have Gene in, the historical genius he really is. We're in here to do our little bit as best we can with our meager resources to try to help deprogram our white children that have been beaten down since they were even pre-K. In pre-K school, to grammar school, to high schools, universities, they've been told how low down and stinking rotten that the Confederates were, how low down and stinking rotten Southerners are, how low down and stinking rotten they are for being white. We're trying to reverse all that. We're trying to give our young people some true history and to connect them to their roots, their glorious roots, their great, almost holy roots of being white. Especially, there's no soldiers, no people on earth who's ever lived that was more righteous. I'm not saying they were saints, but they were more righteous and more brave and more great than your Southern ancestors. And that's why we do this, to connect, to try to negate all these damn lies being put forth in the public school system, in the media, and even in the churches. So go ahead, Bitterender.
Okay. Thank you, Eddie. Well, that's a great reason why we do it. But that's what the communists do. They destroy a country from the inside. And they tell you your history and your family were bad, but communism is great. And progressivism or liberalism or whatever you want to call it, they don't come out and call it communism, but it's the same thing. If you look at the Communist Manifesto and what the people have been putting on us for the last 30 or 40 years, it's exactly the same thing, except one was written in Russian or German and one is written in English. So, yeah, it's an uphill battle, but we're going to keep doing it. You had a question about famous artillery batteries. There are two that people have probably heard of. It was in Forest Artillery. First was Captain Samuel Freeman's battery, and he was a professor at Cumberland University or Cumberland College back then, and then organized this artillery battery, and he was killed when Forrest's men were coming into Franklin early in the war in 1863. A federal cavalry unit coming over from Murfreesboro just by chance ran into the Confederate cavalry strung out up and down the Lewisburg Pike, and they hit the artillery, which was in the middle of the column, and they were trying to unlimber the guns and fight off the federal cavalry. And a cannon rolled over the leg of Captain Freeman.
Oh, wow.
And he couldn't run. And the federal soldiers were telling them to run, get out of here, we're capturing the guns. He couldn't run, so they shot him right through the face and killed him right there. Forrest, of course, was up toward the head of the column. He heard all this shooting, came back and drove the Yankees away. And there was Captain Freeman laying on the ground. And he got off his horse and held him. And it brought tears to his eyes. Said, none braver than Captain Freeman. And then the other battery that Forrest had was John Morton, Morton's battery. And he had taken over. He was a very young man, and he was assigned to Forrest Cavalry. And Forrest said, I don't want that tally-faced youth in my unit. I want somebody that can really do something. And Morton rode all night to come back and beg for a chance to serve under Forrest. He did, and probably became one of the best artillery officers in the war. And so Morton's battery and Freeman's battery were two very famous artillery batteries with Bedford Forrest. Okay, we've covered our organization in the military. We want to move on to one of our March events that we had in Confederate history. And this not only was a Confederate history event, this was one of the greatest events in world history, in military history, and special Navy history. We want to talk about the first battle between ironclad ships. And that took place in our war for Southern independence. Stephen Mallory was named as Secretary of the Navy in the Confederate government. And he originally was a senator from Florida. He was on the Naval Affairs Committee in the United States Senate. And he tried and tried and tried to get the United States Navy to start building ironclad ships. He said, England and France are building ironclad warships. And that's what we're going to have to fight in the next war. But the Navy traditionalists said, oh, no, no, there's nothing better than the great sailing ship. No, no. He did talk them into building six modern steam frigates. Now, these were sailing ships with three masts and about 40 guns on them and steam-powered. So if there wasn't any wind or they had to negotiate a real tricky channel to get into a harbor, they could furl the sails and use steam power to get in. Anyway, so the war comes along. Florida secedes. He joins the Confederacy, and because of his naval experience in the U.S. Congress, Jefferson Davis and the Confederate Congress named him Secretary of the Navy. And so the Confederacy had no navy. They had a bunch of tugboats, and they had some ferries, and they were trying to make them, turn them into warships. So they didn't have any tradition. So what Stephen Mallory wanted to do was build as many of these ironclad warships as they possibly could to offset the numbers in the Federal Navy. And one of the ships they built was the hull of a U.S. ship that had been burned at Gosport Navy Yard. When Virginia seceded, they burned the supplies there to keep the new Confederate government from getting. And they had a ship in dry dock, the USS Merrimack. And they burned it, and this wasn't real brilliant. They set it on fire to burn it, and then they drilled holes in the hull so it sank and put the fires out. But it burned it down to the gun deck. The main deck on top that you see where all the big cannons would have been, artillery pieces would be on a ship, that was burned off, and it went down to the deck below that, the gun deck. So the Confederates got it. They cleared all of it off, and they built a casement over the top of the gun deck with slope sides, with heavy timber slope sides, and then bolted metal plates on top of that. And what they did, they tested the angle that they wanted on the side of this ship. What angle would be best to deflect artillery shells or cannonballs coming in? Figured it out to be 36 degrees, and they fired a lot of test artillery at it out in a big field to get the right angle. The bad part about that was Yankee spies figured out what they were doing. They were building a metal ship, ironclad ship, and they reported to the Washington government what the Confederates were doing down at Gosport Navy Yard in Norfolk. And so that got the Yankees off their rear end, and they started building metal ships. John Erickson was the builder that they got to build a metal ship for them, and which had been rejected before the war. So on the morning of March the 8th, 1862, the commander of the new ship, the CSS Virginia was the name of this new ship, and they call it the Merrimack and the battle between the Merrimack and the Monitor. That's not true. There was nothing left of the Merrimack except the hull, and they built this big superstructure over the top of it. In the water, it looked like a roof of a house coming through the water, and the weight of all that steel pushed it down into the water, so there was no wood from the hull of the old Merrimack exposed. So this thing came out of the Navy Yard at Gosport and stormed out into Hampton Roads, which is the part of the water that's at the south end of the Chesapeake Bay, and went after the Federal blockade squadron there. The ships, the Confederate ironclads, also had a ram built into the front of it, which is a big triangular piece of metal bolted into the bow, and a lot of times these ships would ram into the hull of a wooden ship, knock a hole in it, and sink it. It's kind of ironic. Back in the old days, that was how you destroyed an enemy's fleet. The Greeks, the Phoenicians, the Roman galleys, they had a ram on the front, and they would just ram it into the side of another ship, sink it, or then they would climb on board and attack it, where they would use their marines or sailors to board the other ship. But when gunpowder came along, then you didn't want to get close enough to try to ram a ship. So that backed people out way off, the British and French Navy. You didn't want to try to get in there and ram them. They'd shoot your ship to pieces. But go back to the ram when these ironclad ships came along, because now gunpowder and firing cannonballs wasn't doing any good. They just bounced off. So the ram was a perfect offensive weapon to tear a hole in the bottom of a ship. The Virginia comes out. It goes after the first ship that it went to was the USS Congress, the fleet there, that morning of March the 8th. And it rammed it and sank it. And then it blasted the USS Cumberland and set it on fire, and it sank. And then it went after the USS Minnesota, and they decided they'd seen enough. And they tried to get out of there and ran the ship aground. And the Virginia couldn't go over there because they'd run aground. The tide was going out. So March the 8th, the CSS Virginia that Stephen Mallory had ordered the Confederate Navy to build took out three of the six ships that he had built for the U.S. Navy before the war, that they agreed to those six frigates. In one morning, this ironclad ship knocked out three of the six that he had worked so hard to get the U.S. Navy to build. Now, the next morning, we will finish up the battle on the next day, March the 9th, after we come back from the break.
Can't wait to hear that, Gene. Be right back, folks.
As you are aware, America is divided over every fault line possible. This is intentionally fostered by those who do not love God, family, or country. We believe a peaceful future as a free people absolutely depends on civility. Clarion Call for Civility is looking for funding and volunteers at every level to make our hopes and efforts a reality. Please donate, sign our pledge, and help us in our sacred cause. Please visit callforcivility.com for more details. callforcivility.com.
I'm Pastor Everett Ramsey, pastor of Faith Baptist Church. A congregation of God's covenant people, informed Christians know that we are at the brink of a long-planned one-world government being executed that will not tolerate true Christian faith. There is a way to stop it. Our church has used God's spiritual weapons of warfare many times over the years, and in every case that was properly executed, the Church of Jesus Christ has been delivered. It is called the Court of Divine Justice. David used it many times. Read Psalm 37, Psalm 109. It includes truthful information, repentance, and imprecatory prayers. Blood River Radio is the only radio station I know that supports action based on truth about lies concerning the Confederacy, the Civil Rights Movement, the German people, the true Holocaust, and who the true covenant people of God are, and the sins and failures of the churches, if any of these. This means anything to you, and it should, then please say so with your money, as well as prayers. You may obtain information from us about the Courts of Divine Justice by sending your offering and request to Blood River Radio, and we take none of the money.
Bypass the mainstream narrative with Liberty News Radio at libertynewsradio.com. Engage with charismatic hosts live or on demand. We cover the crucial news focused on God, family, and country. News that other networks simply refuse to use. Think of LNR's hard-hitting news and podcasts at your fingertips, anytime, anywhere. Join us at libertynewsradio.com. Empower your day with the truth, because the truth will set you free. libertynewsradio.com.
Dear Blood River Radio family, without further ado, because time is money and Gene has a long ways to go, the short time to get there, the bitter ender is the only. Yeah, he's got to go. He's on the Mallard Calvary ride right now. Go ahead, get away, bitter ender.
Sure. Okay, take we're talking about the history breaking first battle of ironclad ships between the CSS Virginia and the USS Monitor. So the Virginia pretty well knocked out the federal fleet in Hampton Roads on the morning of March the 8th. And then that afternoon, they had to go back into Gosport Navy Yard because the tide was going out. And the thing was that this ship was built over the hull of an ocean-going ship. So it had a deep keel, like a V, that went deep into the water, because a ship out in the ocean has to have ballast to ride out these high seas and waves and things. So it's got a deep keel, and the iron plating that they put over the top of that forced that keel down even further in the water. So there was the Virginia couldn't get close to the shore. It had to stay in the main channel. And then as the tide was going out, they had to come back into port. Now, during that night of March the 8th, the USS Monitor showed up, which was just a flat piece of metal, looked like, with a round turret on it. And they called it cheese box on a raft. So, but it had a flat bottom. So it could go in close to the shore than the Virginia could. And it went in to protect the other federal wooden hull ships in the blockade squadron if the Virginia came out the next morning on the 9th, which is exactly what happened. So the Virginia comes out. They see this odd-looking thing sitting out there, and they open fire on it, and then now their shells are bouncing off of this ship. So they tried to ram it, and the Virginia didn't have enough power to get up enough steam and speed to run over the ship. They hit it a couple of times, and the steel hull of this monitor just bounced off, knocked it back a few feet, but it didn't punch a hole in it. So this thing went on for most of the morning, these battles between these two ironclad ships. The commander of the CSS Virginia on the previous day, on March the 8th, was Franklin Buchanan. And after they rammed the Cumberland and it started going down, he brought the Virginia in close to shore to Fortress Monroe to pick up the U.S. Navy sailors that were in the water, and some of them were drowned. And that was sort of the thing in the Navy. When you sink a ship and there's the enemy sailors are in the water, you pick them up, get them out of the water. That's a courtesy from one Navy to another. Well, he got in close to Fort Monroe, and the Yankee soldiers in Fort Monroe opened fire on the Virginia, rifle fire. And they shot Captain Buchanan in the leg, wounded him in the leg. Really nice. They're out there trying to pick up U.S. sailors out of the water, and U.S. soldiers at Fort Monroe were shooting at him, and he got wounded. On the next battle, on the 9th, the Virginia was under the command of his second-in-command, Commander Catesby. Lieutenant Commander Catesby Jones was now in command for the wounded Captain Buchanan. So they were going to come out and finish off the rest of the blockade squadron, but they ran into this monitor thing, and they banged away at each other all morning, and neither one could get an advantage. And so the monitor actually pulled back and went into shallow waters because their captain, a Confederate artillery shell exploded right into one of the openings in that turret, and the captain of the monitor was blinded. And so they pulled back, and once again they pulled into the shallow water. The monitor had a flat bottom. The Virginia had that deep keel under it. They couldn't go in there and get them, so they went back to Gosport Navy Yard. And they came out several other times during March and into April and fought. You know, the monitor was always positioned to be between the Virginia and the wooden hull ships of the blockade squadron. And so they were just drawn battles or inconclusive battles and banging away at each other and bouncing shells off of each other. What happened, though, to the Virginia was that Norfolk fell to the U.S. Army, and they couldn't go back to port because they didn't want the U.S. Military to capture their ironclad ship and turn it on them. They couldn't take the Virginia up the James River. It drew too much water, and you couldn't use it in the James River fleet to protect Richmond and the capital on the James River. They couldn't go back to port because now Norfolk and Gosport Navy Yard were in control of the Federal Army. So they packed it full of gunpowder, took it out into the channel there in Hampton Roads, set it on fire, and blew it up. And so the Federals couldn't get it. The Confederates built quite a few of these ironclad ships. One of the biggest was the CSS Tennessee in Mobile Bay. And during the Battle of Mobile Bay, the Tennessee took on 19 Federal ships of Farragut's Navy in Mobile Bay. Another one was the Arkansas, that was built on the Yazoo River in Mississippi. Interesting ship. They used railroad rails for armor plating on that. And the last trip that the train made, it took up the railroad ties behind, I mean, the railroad rails behind it for the last trip and used that for the armor plating. Then they took the steam engine apart and used the steam engine as power for the steam engine on this Arkansas. And it came out of the Yazoo River, came into the Mississippi. They were supposed to be on just a trial run, but the current took them down river, and they ran right through the Federal fleet that was up above Vicksburg. And so they had Federal ships on the right, on the left. their gunners were firing away on the right and the left, and the Yankees were firing at this ship, and everything that missed the Arkansas went across the river and hit one of their own ships. And once again, it got down below Vicksburg, and the engines were in such bad shape that they couldn't get it to turn around, and they tried repairing it, and 2 or 3 weeks later, they had to blow it up. Another one was the Chicora and the CSS Charleston in Charleston Harbor, and they just beat the living daylights out of the federal fleet that was trying to come into Charleston all through the war during the siege of Charleston. They couldn't get close to the city of Charleston because these two ironclads and all the coastal forts at Fort Moultrie, at Battery Wagner, and, of course, the Confederates now had Fort Sumter, and that protected Charleston. Once again, though, when the Federal Army was closing in on Charleston from the land side, the Confederates had to blow up their naval ships. The Albemarle in the sounds in the areas in North Carolina, Albemarle Sound, it destroyed the U.S. Blockade fleet off of Cape Hatteras. And then the object of the ironclads was to keep the ports open for blockade runners to come in. The ironclads would go out and attack the federal blockade squadrons, and then these coastal forts like Fort Sumter at Charleston, Fort Fisher at Wilmington, North Carolina, Fort Morgan down at Mobile, places like that, or Fort Pulaski in Savannah, they would keep the ports open for these blockade runners to come in along the coast. And the federal fleet didn't want to get in close to the port city because once they did, they came under attack by the ironclads and these big heavy guns that they had in these forts. Oh, going back to what we were talking about, the early artillery, the 12-pounder, brass Napoleon, 10-pound Parrott rifle, that was all called field artillery. And that hooked onto a little two-wheel cart with an ammunition chest called a limber, and you'd have 4 to 6 horses that could pull it around. That could move all over. But these big coastal guns and guns on these heavy guns on these warships, once they were put in place, that was it. You couldn't move them around. They were too heavy to be moving around across the countryside. So they had them built into a fort or some type of coastal defenses, and they were there from whenever they were put in place at the first of the war to the end of the war. But it fired a lot bigger shells, of course, that they had to use to attack enemy ships. That was the defenses of these coastal cities to keep the ports open for the blockade runners to come in. And most of these port cities were never closed by the U.S. Navy. They fell from Sherman's army coming in from the land side, or Grant or somebody's army coming into the port city from the land side. And then Charleston was closed, or Wilmington, or Mobile, or Savannah, or wherever the port was, it usually fell to the U.S. military by the Army taking over the port. It never was captured by the Federal Navy. And one of the last battles of the war, naval battles, Admiral Raphael Sims, who was the captain of the Commerce Raider, the Alabama, after it was sunk off the coast of Cherbourg, France, he got back to the United States through Matamoros, Mexico, got across the Mississippi on a homemade raft, went all the way back up to Richmond, and asked what was his next duty assignment. They gave him the James River Squadron, which was only 4 or 5 ships, but that was all that was left. In April of 1865, that was all that was left of the Confederate Navy. And so when Richmond was abandoned in Petersburg and Lee pulled the Army of Northern Virginia out, heading west, which eventually wound up at Appomattox, but they were heading west, Admiral Sims did not want the Federal Navy to be the first enemy troops into Richmond. So he took the James River Squadron and sank them in the James River so the Federal Navy couldn't get upriver and get to Richmond. And then he left and marched with the Army as an Army commander with the troops. And then he and quite a few of the sailors and Marines were split off from Lee's Army. There were several routes that they were using to leave Richmond, and he was on the most southern route. And they got split off, and they heard that Lee had surrendered, so they turned south and went down to North Carolina and joined up with Joe Johnston's army, and that's where he was surrendered. So hope that'll give our folks a little bit of information about the Confederate Navy and some of the military terms and military organization during our war for Southern independence.
And maybe we can cover, I didn't know that they had left Lee's army and gone and joined another force. But maybe we can mention that when we come back next time. Well, God bless you, dear Blood River Radio audience. God bless you, Gene, for coming on and doing this sacred duty that we have to educate our young people, to tell them that they are worthy, God does love them, and the Confederacy was right. Dear Blood River Radio family, thank you so much, and we'll tune in same time, same place next week. 29th of March. Good night, everybody.